to me and kind of tried to involve me into solid state physics, which I kind of never did before. And it started as an attempt to break laws, that's what Russians are very good in doing. And so we started by breaking Ohm's law, and then somehow one thing went to another. It's, after a year and a half, it's a very kind of booming subject. I gave a talk here exactly at the beginning, a year and a half ago, and stole the first small part of it. So now, if there are some people who were there, I'll try not to repeat myself much and more focused on other things. So what we say flow, what does it mean by flow? We use this word pretty freely in different contexts. And when we talk about the flow of a fluid or when we talk about the flow of electrons, do we mean the same thing? And essentially, when we're talking about hydrodynamic approach, as physicists, we usually talk about macroscopic phenomena, namely that we coarse grain over whatever small things and whatever atomic discrete nature of a medium exists. We consider it large scale. We assume that a local piece of matter is some kind of a local thermal equilibrium, which could be characterized by a macroscopic parameter. And one of these macroscopic parameters would be velocity. Another would be like the temperature or density. And it would be collectively flowing. Now, when we talk about electrons, for example, then in a simple case, it is just described by Ohm's law, which, if you really boil it down to high school physics without much sophistication, is the following thing. So you say that your current is basically your velocity. And what happens to every electron? It is in the electric field, which accelerated. This is its acceleration, force divided by mass. And you multiply it by a typical time, which it takes to hit some obstacle, which could be a phonon or it could be an impurity, where it loses its momentum. So you accelerate, it loses momentum. I'm talking about X component of momentum. And so your typical velocity would be, it's an Aristotelian word, your velocity is proportional to your force, and your force is a gradient of your potential in this case, and that would give you an Ohm's law in which current is proportional to the voltage. There is no flow here. It's every electron, it's basically one particle picture, right? There is no collective motion. Of course, you can say that current flows from here to here, but basically this is a picture of, on the other hand, electrons do interact with each other. And we may say, okay, but apart from a typical time, which we call tau p, and which is inverse rate would be gamma p, is a typical rate by which particle lose momentum from electron system to, say, lattice. There could be another time, which would be an interaction time between electrons, and they exchange momentum between each other. And typically, until recently, the rate with which electrons lose momentum to the lattice was much larger, or a typical time to hit the obstacle were much shorter than the typical time of exchanging momentum between electrons. And that's why we had Ohm's law. But now we have high mobility materials. And this, in these materials, in principle, those are estimates which I'm not going to somehow substantiate. But there are some materials, and not only graphene, there are some other materials in which they're so clean and mobility is so high, which means that this gamma is actually the typical time of is so large, then electrons start to effectively interact with each other. And only in this case, you can really see a collective motion of electrons. And then you ask, what if such a regime exists? How we can measure it? How we can observe it? And how we can use it? Well, one other way to look at it is that particularly if you look at the graphene, and you look at it near neutrality point, where it's kind of a relativistic fluid in which you would have a linear dispersion relation.
Can I just ask a question? What is P and F? Is 10 to the what?
Huh?
In the previous slide.
In the previous slide, this was 1 over tau P, which was scattering time.
I understood the definition. I just forgot what FS and PS is. So.
This is femtoseconds and this is picoseconds, which in a sense tell you that in these materials, the typical time.
Minus 15, 10 minus 12.
Yeah, okay. To put it simply, the typical time of exchanging momentum between electrons is actually many times shorter than the typical time to lose momentum to a lattice. So in a sense, electrons can interact effectively with each other before they lose all the momentum. And in essential, fluid mechanics is a collective motion where really you can consider it as a propagation of a conserved quantity. But for this, you really need that the rate by which you lose momentum, this conserved quantity, is lower. And one of the other ways saying that this, at least near neutrality point, would be like quantum electrodynamics, but with a constant, fine structure constant, which is not small. It's actually of order unity. And that's what makes this strongly interacting system. And now you ask if this would be a regime in which interaction between electrons dominate, then it would be that the momentum actually can propagate in space. You start accelerating electrons here, and they interacting would produce the diffusion of momentum from point to point. The diffusivity of momentum is called viscosity. So we are now starting to talk about viscous motion of a fluid in which your momentum diffuses from point to point rather than being lost locally. So you locally accelerate, it's lost. You accelerate, it's lost. Now it starts to diffuse. And this diffusion is characterized by kinematic viscosity, which is a typical velocity times typical mean free path. That's, as any diffusivity is always some typical velocity times some typical mean free path. And in particularly, if you compare, for example, water, which has a very low kinematic viscosity, and the air, which is 15 times more viscous kinematically. Namely, if you see a vortex in the water and the same vortex in the air, then one will die 15 times faster. And the faster dying will be in the air. And this, I'm jumping ahead of them. This is the already result of the measurements, which I'll later show. That's what would be a typical viscosity of electron fluid in graphene. And of course, it's related to the fact that V is kind of large, and also L is large, relatively. So I just want you to remember, and we'll return to the point, that the diffusivity of momentum is called viscosity, and it's a typical velocity times typical mean free path. And for example, for usual gas, it will be thermal velocity or speed of sound, which is of the same order, times mean free path of the molecules. And now the question is, if indeed such a regime exists, how we can find it? What kind of macroscopic measurements we can do so that we can establish that this is not the Ohm's law, but this is something which is a viscous collective motion of electrons. And if it is a collective motion, it is, again, I am now considering this regime in which this rate of electron interaction is much larger than the rate of losses. Then I can describe it by a macroscopic equation in which V is already macroscopic velocity coarse-grained over scale much larger than the mean free path. That's my viscosity is defined by this. And what is pressure or chemical potential mainly come from electrostatic potential. And this is the book on fluid mechanics in which you can find all the details. Now, it looks trivial, and it isn't. So if I'm considering a stationary flow, it tells me that the gradient of pressure is balanced by the viscous friction force. And it may look trivial, but, and this is, by the way, the world in which all bacteria, all microorganisms live in this world. They live on a very small scale where whatever they try to, for example, swim. What is important here is this gives you, again, it's an Aristotelian world, right? But in a way different from Ohm's law, but then again, your velocity, Laplace velocity, is proportional to your gradient of pressure. And it means that if you would try to swim in such a medium, then you would need to change your shape periodically. Namely, at the end of a cycle, you return to the same shape, but you would move in space. Now there is a theorem that if your change of your shape is reversible, then you would return to the same place. You would not move. It's called sometimes scallop theorem. And so this is which means that if you really want to move, or you want to pump, which means that you move fluid with respect to you, you need to change your shape in a non-reversible way, which means that all this is pure geometry. It's actually subject of a gauge field theory, which Frank Wilczek realized at some point. And this is an example of a swimmer, which, I mean, if you really make something irreversible, you need at least two variables so that you need to make a circle in some configuration space. And in particular, this is the simplest example of it. You have a swimmer which characterized by two parameters. So you can change these angles of these arms, and this is a cycle. So you return to the same shape that you were initially, and it's a nice exercise which I give to my students, how to show that this motion actually, how much it's shifted, is proportional to the area. It's a pure case of a geometric phase, what is called. Now I want to show that it's not that trivial, and some microorganisms actually unable to master it. That's a fish fry which tries to swallow a plankton. 80% of fish fry die because they cannot master the way to do it irreversibly. You see, it enters and then it exits because it tries to change the shape. So this is quite a non-trivial scene. And okay, so you try to swallow this guy. So you open and then you close, but it goes out. You see, it tells you how, basically it's called Stokes' equation. So this guy tries to solve Stokes' equation, and apparently only those 20% they know how to solve Stokes' equation and do a circle in configuration space survive. The other die of hunger. That's intricacy of, I just want to illustrate to you that linear viscous fluid mechanics is a non-trivial discipline. First of all, there is no time there because everything is kind of happens simultaneously. There is no DDT, time derivative. It's pure geometry. It just gauge field theory. Now, returning to our question, we again start from kind of a simple thing. And the first thing you say, okay, let's say I have a half space like this. I put a current over here. And I create some positive voltage here, and I have zero voltage at infinity, so I have a half space. And now I'm making a current flowing, and then, of course, my current would flow in straight lines. There are two different types. Actually, we don't know what are the true boundary condition in graphene, in other materials that we saw. So that's why, as a theoretician, try to solve problem with different boundary condition and see what is similar and what is not. So boundary condition could be just no slip, so that velocity on this boundary is zero, or it could be no stress, namely that it's like vacuum. So there's the stress here, namely the velocity derivative is zero. It's very similar. The current flows in a straight line, so what you expect. But the color here is a potential. And you see that there is 45 degrees. Of course, this is all complex analysis. A little bit later, I'll return to it. It's kind of a relatively simple and beautiful mathematics involved. But the solution is given here. That's a potential. And it's proportional to cosine 2 theta. Here, theta is this angle. And it changes sign at 45 degrees, which tells you that here is your potential is positive. At infinity, it's zero. So here, it decreases along this line, namely electric field directed along the current. But here your potential is negative, namely, and at infinity it's zero, namely your potential increases along this line, which means that electric field is directed against the current, which is kind of natural because a fast flowing current here by friction moves current here, which is slower, and then electric field must be opposite to provide for a stationary current. So again, the moment you change Ohm's law by viscous friction, you are now non-local. Your current here influences the current there. So in this respect, the kind of basic prediction would be that you would clearly violate Ohm's law by making current in some regions flowing against the electric field. So in a sense, this was the simplest prediction when Levitov came to me and asked me what would be the simplest thing that you would have in a viscous flow. Then eventually we came to a conclusion, this is current flowing against gradient. Okay? And of course, in an experimentally realistic geometry, you need to solve it not in a half space, but as some kind of a strip. So, but this is again, so here you look at ohmic flow. Ohmic flow would have potential decreasing in all direction. And here again, you have decreasing in this direction and increasing in this direction. You would also have a side vortices. And clearly, pictures are very different. And so in a sense, answering this first question, what is the macroscopic manifestation of viscous flow would be that you would see a negative resistance. So if you take a current and if you take an electric field, they would have different signs. So when you divide one by another, that would be your resistance, but it will be negative. And in principle, you can solve it in a more general case, and you can also realize that this kind of viscous, ohmic, and electric field is a pure analog of, let's say, microfluidic flow between two plates in which if you take the three-dimensional velocity and integrate it over a vertical coordinate, then on your horizontal velocity, you would have a transversal Laplacian in a plane, and this is a bottom friction, which is analog of an ohmic term, which tells you that you can model, in principle, by microfluidic experiments, what happens in your graphene. And of course, we would be happy, we're happy to do microfluidic experiments, which is just done by a student of mine. It is kind of a simple, you have a small, you need to choose a very hydrophobic surfaces so that you would have almost slip condition and you would have a very small, but then you see really that the flow in this case is like you expected. It has the side vortices as was predicted. The flow here is a inlet, it's an outlet, flow goes like this and it has side vortices. That's more or less microfluidic flow follows Stokes equation. No surprise here, but of course it would be interesting to see it in graphene, in electronics. And that's a computation how if you make such a flow from here to here, but you would measure voltage over here. You would expect this voltage to be negative because it's in this domain which is below 45 degrees. But then again, it depends on what would be a relation between your ohmic terms and your viscosity. Here, eta is your dynamic viscosity, is the density of electron gas. And you see that, of course, when there is no ohmic term, you have here's your electrode, now it's finite. You have this region of negative resistance. And when you increase ohmic term, you see that it disappears. And this is just a computation which you expect to compare with experiment. And here's experiment. And experimentalists and the author of this work were totally independent. So they came to this idea totally independently of us. It's the idea that you need to measure resistance aside, where they call it non-local resistance, from the electrodes. And so they run current this way. It's a little bit different geometry. So this is the way that you run current. Here is gold electrodes, and this white is a graphene sample. So you run current in this way, and you measure voltage in this way. So if you measure voltage aside, and then you see in some interval of parameters, negative response, which were the more or less confirmation. This work was published in the same more or less in the same week in this February and March 2016. And exactly at the same time, within a week, there were totally different experimental work which confirmed in the same more or less interval of parameters the existence of the strongly interacting electron flow on a totally different way. And now I'll say a few words about it. It's about what is called Weidemann-Franz law, which is what is the relation of thermal conductivity and electric conductivity. So if you say that if you have non-interacting electrons, every electron give you a conductivity and the same electron could give you a heat flow, and then you would expect that this is called Lorentz number, and it would be for non-interacting electrons would be expressed as this number. Surprisingly, most of materials do have, this is a two different graphs, and you see most of them, most the different materials, and they all more or less cluster very, very close to this line, which is 2.5, which corresponds to this number. This is why it's called Weidemann-Franz. It's not a theorem. It's kind of a it's a theorem for non-interacting electrons, but for empirically, it's a very, very well established law. Now, if you would have an electron hole system, and then you realize that they would conduct heat and current differently as long as they interact. Because when you have hot and cold system, your electrons and holes would move together, and their interaction would be relevant. Now, if you have a current flowing system, then your holes and electrons would move in opposite direction, and if they interact, they would put drag on each other. So you would expect that in this case, your thermal conductivity would be much higher than your electric conductivity. And this is precisely so that your Lorentz number would be larger than this 2.5 magic number, which people everywhere seen. And this is Casey Funk, who actually did this experiment in Boston, more or less in the same interval of parameter. And I just want to call your attention to the temperature in which it is observed. So this is the ratio of thermal conductivity to the electric conductivity. And you see the interval of temperature more or less between 20, 30 degrees and 100 something. It's a pretty wide interval of temperature in which you see a huge increase of thermal conductivity with respect to electric conductivity. And this is another sign that you have a strongly interacting electron flows. And then we start to explore this regime. So in a sense, that was kind of a first part of my talk, which tells that we found this regime by two independent things, one by seeing negative conductivity or by current flowing against electric field. This is the most clear breakdown of Ohm's law. And the second by breaking Weidemann-Franz law. So we broke two laws, and these two signs tell us more or less in the same interval of concentration and temperature that we have strongly interacting flow. And then we ask, so what? So what must be the properties of this flow? And one particular question is, if we do have an interaction between electrons, what would be, how it would influence the conductivity of the medium? Imagine that I have this interaction, and for example, I change mean free pass, which you will see possible by changing temperature. By changing temperature, this is a fermionic system. I change this width of the Fermi distribution, and I change interaction between electrons. So we would like to understand how the resistance due to impurities, to scattering on impurities or boundaries, depend on the fact that we now have an interaction. And in a sense, it is this simple thing that you try to push current, and then somebody tries to stop it, and then you ask what happens if this is a strongly interacting system. And it's most natural to start from the simplest setting, from the most basic thing, namely from ballistic resistance, which for some reason unknown to me, because I'm not a condensed matter person, it was called ballistic limit. I don't know why it was called limit. It's not, as you see, it's not actually limit. It's sometimes called, Russians call it Chargin, and it's called Landauer resistance. So just imagine that you have a hole with a width W. So this is a width W, and it's ballistic. Namely, that electrons just flow freely through this hole. And then you ask, what kind of a voltage you need per electron to go. And because electron is a quantum particle, you need to squeeze it through this opening. Then apparently you would have this kind of fundamental H over E squared resistance time, what they call, well, again, this kind of jargon term, ballistic number of channels, but which is basically the typical time of flowing from wall to wall through this thing. And this is a ballistic resistance, which we measured very well, and it's known to satisfy this. Now imagine that you would have now this opening so that there will be enough interaction inside so that it would be a viscous flows, a collective viscous flows of your electrons through this opening. And in this case, your resistance would be, again, proportional to the typical time which it takes to lose momentum, because there is a wall where you lose momentum. But for diffusion, the typical time scales like W squared. It's a typical size squared. And then you see that if you compare this formula, which is 1 over W, and this formula, which is 1 over W squared, then you would expect that for sufficiently large W, if you really go, if your W is getting much larger than the mean free pass, so that you go into Visco regime, then your resistance would be small. And this is something which in a moment will be clear that engineers in dilute gas dynamics know this, but people in condensed matter found it really surprising. And this is our theoretical work where we predicted it. And the mechanism of it is very simple. When you have a ballistic flow, then your current more or less constant along the cross-section of your pipe through which you try to push it. When you're starting to get interacting viscous flow, you would have a Poiseuille, what's called Poiseuille quadratic profile. So you would see as you change a mean free pass, you go from a constant current distribution into the quadratic current distribution. But if you're getting this kind of distribution, there will be less and less particles near the wall, and that's where you actually lose momentum. So what interaction does is what particle who already lost momentum at the wall prevent other particles to come there. And that makes your resistivity less. And that's a mechanism, and that was the prediction. And then the idea, of course, it's a classical idea that if you take a usual gas flowing through the pipe in a, what is called Knudsen regime, in which the size of the pipe is much smaller than the mean free pass, then your particle flow ballistically, and again, you would have your resistance, which is what is the gradient of pressure divided by your typical current, would scale linearly. And if you would increase your size or decrease your mean free pass so that you would pass from a dilute regime into a viscous regime, you would have W squared. And what measured by people in, by engineers who actually do flow gases through pipes, is that your resistance as a function of concentration is a decreasing function of concentration. Because as you increase concentration, you decrease mean free pass and you pass from ballistic regime into the viscous regime and your resistance decreases. That somehow made experimentalists ecstatic in condensed.
So can I just ask again, just to see if I understood your explanation about the particles close to the wall. So can I think that the particle close to the wall slows down, then the next particle comes and there is like a time advance because the one which is close to the wall helps it deflect and not reach the wall.
The particles, in a sense, you lose when you're in a collective flow, you need your momentum to diffuse to the wall. Okay, and when you create this profile of a current, it means that the particle near the wall almost not moving. And because they're not moving, they not lose much momentum to the wall. But now, let me answer this question in a little bit more general setting. So let's consider a more realistic case for condensed matter so that I have scatterers. And now I know that if I would have a ballistic flow, then the typical time by which I lose momentum, as we discussed on the very first transparency, was a typical flight between scatterers. So you kind of get particle accelerated, then it hit next scatterer, it loses its momentum. Now, if you have a viscous flow, then again, your particles start to flow collectively and avoid scatterers. Okay. Moreover, because it's two dimensions, so this is your ballistic conductance and this is the increase. And you see there is a large logarithmic factor which is peculiar to two dimension. It's related to, of course, to the fact that the diffusion is peculiar in two dimension, or viscosity is peculiar in two dimension. It's called Stokes paradox. It's the following statement, that if you take a cylinder in a fluid and you have a flow perpendicular to the cylinder, then it's a two-dimensional problem. And you may ask how, if you have a flow very far from this cylinder, how it is related to the flow gradient on a cylinder. And the answer is that it's logarithmic. And it means that your flow near the cylinder is logarithmically suppressed relating to the other flow. And this was known, of course, since Stokes, since 19th century. What was not known, to much our surprise, and it's published this year is that what happens when your scatterer is smaller than the mean free path? Because you would expect that in this logarithm there would be a typical size between, typical distance between scatterer divided by mean free path. But if my size A is less than the mean free path, then what comes here is this factor. And this is already something in the ballistic regime. So imagine that your scatterer is small, so that you have a mean free path which is larger than the size of the scatterer. How inside this ballistic regime you have a suppression of resistivity? It's because the particles that scattered of the obstacle prevent other particles to come to the obstacle. So it's a mechanism which is not like this particle one was scattered off the obstacle and prevented particle two to get to the obstacle. And that, of course, decreases resistivity because you lose momentum only over here. That's where it leaks out of the system. So this mechanism of avoiding obstacles not only work in this opposite limit of hydrodynamic regime where you consider everything on a scale much larger than the mean free path, but it also works inside this ballistic regime. And in particular, it's important because in most graphene experiments, this is mean free path is pretty large. So even when mean free path is of order of your system, namely that it, you not in exactly in a hydrodynamic regime, this enhancement of conductivity would be significant. And that was the prediction. This was prediction in this work. And then it was a series of experiments. So let me describe these experiments where it was actually found. And it was looked in and was found that indeed you can get a super ballistic experience. So this is now gray is graphene, and there are different gates of different sizes. So W changes by different sizes, and you run current or between this and this. And next experiment, you run it between this and this, so your current goes through this opening, and then you may study what is indeed would be a current at a given voltage. So you just measure a resistance, and you measure this resistance at different temperatures and as a function of this width. And in particular, you want to know if this width is, if this dependence would be indeed quadratic. And that's the experiments. That was just, it's still not, in, it's online in August. In a sense, this was kind of what a theoretical prediction of what would happen to the current. And this would be, just I jump kind of to the most important part of it. So you measure a resistivity as a function of a temperature. And at every W, the line is this Landauer formula, namely the ballistic quantum resistivity, which was supposed to be limit. And you see that it's not limit, that indeed by increasing temperature, you increase interaction. You decrease mean free path, you increase interaction. That's what happened when you increase temperature in this interval. At larger temperatures, phonons takes over and you just have a normal ohmic resistance and a normal ohmic regime. But here you see that indeed your resistance is much smaller than ballistic resistance. And moreover, you can go and see it now for dependence on concentration. You can map on the concentration in temperature domain where you would have this superballistic conductivity, and you can compare it with the experiments of negative resistivity and see that exactly in those intervals of parameters where you have negative resistivity and violation of Wiedemann-Franz law, so that indeed you expect strongly interacting flow, that you would have a superballistic resistivity. And you can also check over here that if you consider, it's work. You need to get kind of a computation of different parameters so that you can really isolate the respective part of conductivity, and there would be no fitting parameters. And then you may see that it is as a function of a W, it's indeed a quadratic line. Or if you plot it as a function of W square, it is a straight line, which more or less tells you that this is a diffusive viscous regime. So now really your resistivity scales as a squared width of a channel and not linearly as it did in a ballistic regime, and that's more or less a confirmation of the fact that you are in a viscous regime. But moreover, again, to much surprise of the people in this field, this resistivity is smaller than ballistic. So when you go from ballistic regime to viscous regime, your resistivity, because of scattering on the edges, decreases. Because collective flow avoids scatterers, it avoids edges, and that's a mechanism of it. Yet another interesting thing, which is still work in progress, is that your viscosity, I'm not going back to the slide, let me just remind you that viscosity is a diffusivity of momentum and is proportional to the typical velocity, which is Fermi velocity over here, it depends only on concentration. So for a given concentration is fixed, times mean free pass. So your viscosity proportional to mean free pass. And mean free pass is something that you can change by changing temperature and changing the strength of interaction. And then you see that when you decrease your mean free pass, you decrease your viscosity, and at some point, your mean free pass would be comparable to the scale of your system. Or you increase mean free pass, and at some point, you go from when you have a very small mean free pass, you're in a viscous regime. When you increase mean free pass, you make weaker and weaker and weaker interaction, you pass to ballistic regime. And in this point, when you pass to ballistic regime, your mean free pass is large, it's the size of your system, which means that your viscosity is maximal. So it tells you that all these viscous effects, if you look at them, they are maximal before disappearing. This is a negative resistance as a function of kind of a temperature. And so you see that it increases, 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 and then you come into a ballistic regime and it changes sign. And this is kind of an anomaly in a sense that you would have something maximal just on the verge of disappearance. And this is a set of very interesting phenomena. This is something which we already have a data and we already have a kind of a theory. And this is a work that is done with Andrei Shitov, the theoretical part, and experiments are the same Manchester experiments. And the last thing that I want to discuss here is something which is kind of almost elementary, and it's in a sense a basic fluid mechanics, and I did not know it, even though I teach fluid mechanics 20 years. And this is how one can have a free flow of a very viscous fluid. Let me just remind you that if I have a ohmic case, it tells me that, and it's in incompressible flow, namely, I don't have any volume charges, so my divergence of my velocity is equal to zero, then I may introduce a stream function, which automatically makes me satisfy this incompressibility. And in this case, I would see that I would have Cauchy-Riemann relating my stream function and my potential. So in a sense, in two dimensions, ohmic flow, it's a simple complex analysis which tells me that I have stream function and potential, no volume charges, satisfying Laplace equation. And viscous flow is different. And it's different because now it's not a potential flow. It's now a Laplacian of velocity, which is a gradient of phi, which means that a curl of velocity, which is called vorticity, is generally non-zero. It's not potential flow, it's rotational. But now, if I introduce this omega, then I've realized that it is omega now, which is a Cauchy-Riemann counterpart of potential. So not stream function, but omega corresponds to the real and imaginary part of some complex potential. And consequences of it are pretty unexpected. And somehow we never explored in fluid mechanics for reason which I don't know why Stokes did not realize, but let me tell you something very which I find surprising. Assume that you have a metal electrode, just spherical, and you put it into a medium and make your current flowing in just the radial directions, okay? In a sense, you never have it in fluid, you never had it before in fluid mechanics, because in fluid mechanics, it's very difficult to imagine a source of a fluid inside a fluid which would make it going out. Of course, in a car, in an electronic system, it's pretty straightforward. You just put metallic electrode. It has a potential constant on the surface. It has current flowing radially. Now, of course, in two dimensions, your velocity will be 1 over r. It's simple, right? Laplacian of 1 over r is 0. Well, it's delta function, but it's kind of 0 everywhere outside. What it tells you? It tells you that the Laplacian is 0, which means that your gradient of your potential is 0. So your potential is constant everywhere outside of your electrode. It tells you that you have a current which flows, and it does not need any electric field to drive it. But on the other hand, it dissipates. If you consider now the stress tensor, which is just a viscous stress tensor, which is a derivative of velocity, then it's of course non-zero. And the square of it would give you the rate of energy dissipation, and it's non-zero. Namely, it tells you that this current dissipates heat all the time. So you need to do work to drive it. But on the other hand, it has zero electric field outside. And of course, the result of it is that all this drop of voltage must happen on the boundary of your electrode, namely in this mean free pass ballistic layer around it. And in particularly, if you consider, for example, a geometry in which you have an electrode with R1, an electrode with R2, then you would have pressure or potential behaving like this. Or if you invert the current, you would have it like that. And this is something which is kind of, that's what people now trying to measure. Because in a sense, that if you would have an ohmic flow, you would have current locally proportional to the electric field. As you tune your interaction and you would go from ohmic regime to the viscous, you increase interaction, namely you decrease mean free pass, you would expect electric field to go down. Instead, you would expect electric field to be expelled from your bulk of the flow to the region which is of the size of a ballistic layer, namely that all the electric field will be concentrated in the ballistic layer on the electrode. And of course, this is very kind of fascinating, and so far it's very difficult to measure in the graphene sample the distribution of current and potential inside, and there are several techniques which people are now doing experiments in different laboratories. And now, before I'm finished, I want to ask this question, which more or less, I guess, always need to be asked. In a sense, you must be surprised by everything that I told you, because what I did mostly was solving linear Stokes equation, which describes trivial viscous fluid. In a sense, we did some computations about anomalies solving linearized quantum kinetic equation for small deviation from equilibrium. But this is a hugely complicated system with very non-trivial and complicated interaction. It's a relativistic fluid mechanics, in a sense, which is very different from fluid mechanics. And the fact that everything worked so nicely with an experiment, I find very surprising. In a sense, this is probably the result of the fact that we really work in the interval of linear response. And then again, hydrodynamic approach is so powerful because you consider large-scale phenomena which are more or less independent of the details of the microscopic system. And of course, we cannot compute the viscosity of this gas, which would be building a really microscopic theory. But the point is that it works surprisingly well. And in a sense, this is something which is interesting because fluid mechanics is probably one of the last universal languages in which we can talk to each other, in which people from, I don't know, meteorology, astrophysics, condensed matter, engineering, geophysics could talk to each other and understand, including what happens in ion colliders. On the other hand, it's very practically interesting. In a sense, it's an ability to make a non-local electronics, which is people find And this is one of the reasons this research is well-funded, is that people really hope that you can build devices by which you can influence something here by doing something there. And that's what precisely you see when you, I mean, on this most basic thing like negative resistance. And so I want to finish at this point by just saying that there are many interesting regimes, and this work is just starting, and it's apparently the simplest steps which are made. And it's possible that there are many other wonders, because all this science more or less year and a half, in maybe 2 years, starting in the making, and very much hope that there will be other developments. And of course, I promote my book. It's the shortest book on fluid mechanics. So if you feel after this talk that you want to learn fluid mechanics, you're welcome to buy. Second edition will be in 3 months. Thank you very much. Everything was elementary and clear.
Let me just ask a naive question. So as you said, because it's strongly coupled, you can compute some things because perhaps of isodynamics, dynamics, right? Some universality. So is there something else that you would not be able to predict, but which you would measure and see that it's a sign of being strongly coupled and for which you would?
Yes, it's phenomenological science, which means that I cannot predict the value of viscosity, right? I cannot, by the way, compute the value of viscosity of water. Nobody would be able to do it. You can only do it for very dilute gases. So in a sense, the beauty of fluid mechanics is that as long as it's strongly interacting system, means that your mean free path is very small. So you, if your Kerr is gradient on a scale much larger than the mean free path, you're getting phenomenology, which only single unknown phenomenological parameter, which is viscosity, which you measure, but you don't compute it. Well, Sakdiv has some kind of a semi-phenomenological theory about this.
Other questions? Yes, thank you.